Hey friends, hey, and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. In this podcast, you will hear surgeons discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most of the information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinion. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, create a profile and log in. There you can find the episodes in a more searchable fashion. You can also post questions about the various topics that we've discussed, as well as new topics that you'd like to hear discussed. On the website, you can also sign up for the weekly newsletter that will highlight the current episodes. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone you would like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com and I'll get that arranged. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Jake Stuckey. We are excited to kind of give you a little more informational podcast today. Just for those who haven't listened to all the prior episodes, Jake is my brother. He is starting his third year of residency, and we've done several episodes together. But Jake, good to have you back on the episode.
Yep, I'm glad to be here. We've been chatting, you know, a lot recently about different things that we wanted to talk about, and one of the things that I was thinking, you know, as you mentioned, as a resident, we get a lot of, you know, we spend a lot of time going over the core OMS principles and discussing like the high yield thing, studying for the OM site. And I figured it'd be good if we start incorporating just a little bit more of those, you know, high yield things for residents, you know, who are listening to this podcast on their commute so we can kill the OM site and get ready for our boards and whatnot. So one of the things that, you know, I had proposed and I think we're going to be doing a little bit more frequently is like a resident series where we take just high yield, you know, different types of topics and we discuss what are the main points. And then we'll also every once in a while do some board simulation cases, talk about recent literature, journal articles that have come out on important topics just to kind of keep everyone fresh on what's new. So that's kind of the plan. I think we're willing to adjust and to, you know, see how it goes, take feedback. If anyone has feedback, to let us know what kind of things you'd like to hear or if there's any different topics you want us to talk about. And then after these episodes, when I post on the Instagram page, I'll try to post like a little infographic or kind of summary of what we discussed so you guys can refer back to that in the future.
Yep. And then we'll just be titling these when you're kind of looking at them on iTunes or Spotify. We're titling them kind of the subject, which today is MRONJ, and then we'll say resident series after that or before. But either way, we're calling them resident series kind of topics that we're going
to
go over.
Yeah, then you'll be able to find kind of those more information dense ones. And as things go on, we'll, you know, get more of the guests that we've, you know, had on the other podcast or the other kind of series. We'll have those guests on to discuss their topics here as well.
Yep. All right. So today we were going to discuss MRONJ. Now, this is a topic that I have discussed with Tom Schlieve, specifically on one episode, but kind of touched on other episodes. And so definitely something we've discussed, but because the AMIS position paper just came out last month, May 2022, this is very relevant and it's good to review kind of what our specialty, the leaders in our specialty have really noticed and are deciding. And to kind of give you some updates on some of the changes. But this paper, both Jake and I read it. It is an excellent resource. It's very, very detailed, information heavy. I think the actual actual information itself goes on for 17 to 18 pages. And then there's like five more pages of sources after that. So they weren't messing around with this one. They were very thorough. Highly recommend our listeners read this paper because it's really helpful. So we're going to try to summarize it and possibly add some of our own stuff in there as far as just experience, but thought it'd be good to kind of run through this. So Jake, if you can kick us off, maybe you can kind of give us the definition of MRONJ.
Right. So MRONJ is essentially necrosis of the jaw secondary to the effects of the anti-resorptive medications that happens in combination with an inciting event. And this also, to be diagnosed as MRONJ, you know, is something that happens in the absence of metastasis or cancer in the jaw or radiation therapy in the jaws. So like I mentioned, it is associated with certain medications, right? And so we want to discuss those. So we'll discuss what are the medications that can cause MRONJ, and then why are they used? That way we can look out for the patients that are going to be at increased risk for this.
For sure. I mean, the most common ones, I think we're all very familiar with, are the bisphosphonates. There's nitrogen containing and non-nitrogen containing. I think the more potent ones are the nitrogen containing, and probably the ones we're more familiar with, which are Fosamax, also known as alendronate, and then zoledronic acid, Zometa, is probably the one that we're most familiar with as being very, very potent, causative drug of MRONJ. But there's other bisphosphonates, risedronate, romosozumab. Some of these are, we'll kind of go into this later on, but some of these are used for osteoporosis and Paget's disease. Those are kind of the ones I just said. And then risedronate is used for osteogenesis imperfecta, denosumab, which is a RINK-L inhibitor, and the RINK ligand inhibitor, just for those who maybe pimped on this, RINK stands for receptor activator of nuclear factor kappa B ligand. Good heavens. No wonder they shrunk it down to RINK-L. But that one's becoming super familiar and or super common to see in patients. Denosumab will come under many other names, such as Prolia, Xgeva, and that's used for osteoporosis and sometimes as well for cancer. And then there's the antigenic meds that can also be used, and several others, tyrokinase inhibitors, immunomodulatory drugs, VEGF inhibitors. Those aren't quite as potent, certainly, and aren't as commonly used. So the main ones that we're going to be seeing are the bisphosphonates and the RINK-L inhibitors.
Mm-hmm. And then just going off of what you were saying, is that when it comes to like the reasons we use them, you know, we want to be looking out for older patients, right, who could be at higher risk for osteoporosis. Because a lot of times, you know, you'll have those patients, you know, like, let's say you have like an 80-year-old lady who's there for an extraction, and, you know, no, never had anything. And then if you ask specifically, have you ever been diagnosed with osteoporosis? Oh, yeah, of course, I take that Fosamax every day, you know. So it's something that if you know what it's treated for, you can look out for. I also ask patients, you know, have you ever had any types of cancer? Because a lot of times if they have, you know, you can get into this discussion, solid cancers with metastasis to other bones, you know, really could be, they could have had some of these medications for their chemo. Because what these do is they reduce their likelihood of having skeletal related events, you know, like fractures, hypercalcemia, other issues that are related to having metastasis in your bones, right? So looking out for those things when you're doing your workup is always helpful. And then like you were mentioning with the different types of drugs, just discussing like real briefly, how do the bisphosphonates or different anti-resorptive medications work?
Yes. Before we answer that, I was going to also piggyback on that one to say that that's become one of the, I think, main things I'm looking out for in my patients. Anyone who says they're on cancer, you know, immediately I ask them if they're on any bisphosphonates. A lot of them have no idea. Usually I ask them, you know, have you had any metastasis, or, you know, what level is your cancer at? How severe? And if it's like, oh, well, this is pretty bad, you know, stage 4 and getting all sorts of medications, usually we kind of hit the pause button and say, okay, well, let's really research this out before we do anything, you know, if they don't know and have a med list. So those are the patients mm-hmm. that are high risk in my mind for getting MRONJ, you know, certainly much more than the osteoporotic older patient.
Right. So, yeah. And then also, you know, not that I've ever had any specific cases like this, but if you have, you know, patients with cancer and they say it's advanced, knowing if it's, you know, if they have multiple myeloma, if they have prostate cancer, breast cancer, you know, certain cancers that are more commonly going to metastasize to bone, even, you know, your suspicions should be even higher, right?
Yep.
To get that additional information from their doctor.
Real quick, I don't think we said what MRONJ means. Medication-related osteonecrosis of the jaw. You'll find this in the literature as a lot of different, sometimes, acronyms. There's bisphosphonate-related, bisphosphonate-induced is what it was at one point. It's had all sorts of different names, but I think more commonly we're calling it MRONJ now. As far as how, oh, and then also too, in this paper, you'll see that they're using the term anti-resorptive, which we've said already, but that is kind of one you kind of need to include in your vocabulary because there's so many drugs now that aren't bisphosphonates, but are anti-resorptive that now we're kind of encompassing them all with this term anti-resorptive. So how do bisphosphonates work? To answer that question you ask, is there's impairment of osteoclast function, and that's kind of the main causative factor of Emerange, the most potent thing that they can find, because there's so many different factors that seem to cause Emerange, but this one seems to be the most potent. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that, you know, we had discussed the inhibiting the osteoclast function is important because it reduces the turnover of bone, right?
Yeah.
And in all those scenarios that we had talked about, that's what they want to do. You know, they want to reduce the bone loss from osteoporosis. So by calming down the osteoclasts, you know, you're going to have less bone loss. Seeing that, you know, women with decreased estrogen are going to have more bone loss. That's why they want to do that. And then in cancer with metastasis to bones, they want to stop the, you know, essentially the attack on the bones and that progress in the bones. So by slowing down the osteoclast, they can do that. And the ways that the bisphosphonates work is they can deposit in the bone. So when the osteoclasts start working on the bone, they're affected by this medication, which can do one of two things. You know, without getting into too much detail, the bisphosphonates, different types of bisphosphonates, can either just simply inhibit the osteoclast from binding to the bone, or they can cause apoptosis of the osteoclast and just kill them, right? And by those two mechanisms, essentially, they drastically decrease the amount of bone turnover. And if you think about something that's deposited in the bone that stops the turnover of bone, then you can start understanding why it is that bisphosphonates stick around for so many years. And, you know, it's something that we consider is going to be in the blood for, you know, in the bones for 10 plus years. Whereas something like denosumab, which is just an antibody against that Rinko ligand, which can inhibit the osteoclasts, that antibody is not going to stick around nearly as long and is going to be, you know, washed out of our system, you know, they say in about 6 months or so.
Yep. So that's a key kind of differentiator that we'll get to, is that the bisphosphonates are long acting. They really bind strong to our bones and embed for years. And then denosumab or Xgeva, Prolia is not as long acting. And so we'll see why that matters down the road here. As far as what is the pathogenesis of Emerange, what are kind of the different sequences that we're going to run through when we talk about the pathogenesis, Jake?
So basically, you know, there's five main things that the article discussed. First of all, like we mentioned, medication will start by inhibiting bone remodeling, right? So if you have an abnormal remodeling of the bone, normally, you know, you're taking some off, you're putting some on, it's always constantly adjusting to stress. You can imagine when we do something like an extraction and you have issues remodeling the bone, you're setting yourself up for a tricky situation, right? So that's one thing. The second would be inflammation or infection. So that could be periodontal disease. It could be wearing, you know, a poor-fitting denture. It could be doing an extraction, right? You're creating a local area of inflammation where normally, you know, you'd have increased blood flow. You'd have different mediators coming in trying to respond, right? And it's creating kind of a hot spot. And so they found that when you start putting all these factors together, it increases your risk of Emerange in that area. Like I kind of alluded to, angiogenesis inhibition is also can play a role here because, you know, in those settings, you're going to want, you know, increased vascularity to help with the healing of the area, right? To fight off that inciting event. And then they also discussed a little bit about the other roles that are just our immune system in general, in the innate or acquired immune system can have. So briefly, just diabetes, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, patients on systemic glucocorticosteroids, other things like that, they can be at even higher risk because, again, just the body has an even more difficult time, you know, controlling those inciting factors, infections, local conditions. And, you know, if you can't control those things and you're already weakened state, you're going to be at a slightly higher risk for having Emerange, especially with the glucocorticosteroids out of those ones, since, you know, those can in and of themselves affect the bone. And then lastly, genetics. This is kind of a little bit less clear, but they've studied a couple different genes. Some that they mentioned were like SIRT1, which may be a gene that they found could be predictive, which is like, again, going back, it's related to inflammation and angiogenesis. So genes that affect kind of the previously mentioned things may be either good or bad, but, you know, in general, they haven't like nailed down specifically which ones or how we can use those clinically to make any decisions. But it's just another kind of thing to know that might be affecting why people are getting this.
Yeah. And I think this article is great because it really runs through each one of these topics or these mini topics and discusses some of the research that's behind, for example, angiogenesis inhibition and what they've seen. Also those, you know, who've, like Jake was talking about, have used corticosteroids, things that suppress the immune system. I think the take-home message is it's people who are having things messing up their bone and osteoclast issues. And then usually they have other issues going on, things that are compromising their immune system and, you know, kind of dropping down their ability to heal from things. And so when you have kind of both of those things and then you have an inciting event like an extraction, boom, you know, the cascade can start happening. But I think kind of much more rare to find someone who's just on a bisphosphonate and is completely healthy and has no other immune compromising issues to get MRONJ.
Yep, exactly. So moving on a little bit from that background, what is the diagnostic criteria for MRONJ?
So one is, you know, of course, they have to have used an anti-resorptive medication. So one of the ones we've talked about, usually it's going to be the bisphosphonate or the RANKL inhibitor, just denosumab. Two, they have to have exposed bone for 8 weeks, you know, or more. And then three, no history of radiation, of course, because we want to make sure that this is MRONJ and not radio-induced exposed bone. And that leads us into the staging of MRONJ. I'll run through that real quick. If you're good with that, Jake, then you can kind of comment on it. But staging, so there's basically four stages. There's stage zero, which is pain and no exposed bones. So in the article, they call it like, what do they say? They say symptoms that are nonspecific. So basically it's going to be jaw pain, things that are not explained. There's no tooth that is showing, you know, some type of a pathology or anything, but they have pain. And you look around, there's no exposed bone. So that's stage zero. They say that about 50% of those in stage zero are going to convert to stage one. So pretty much exposed bone and MRONJ. So they call it a kind of precursor to MRONJ. Stage one, so basically you have exposed bone now, but no pain. So asymptomatic exposed bone, there's no infection, no swelling. It's just someone who comes in with exposed bone, no pain. Stage two is going to be exposed bone now with pain. And in the article, they put it as exposed and necrotic bone or fistula probes to the bone with evidence of infection / inflammation. So that's interesting too, because technically you can have a situation where it's, you don't see exposed bone, you don't see the bone, but you can see a fistula, you probe through it and it goes to the necrotic bone. So stage two, you've definitely having lots of pain, usually swelling. You can also have some radiographic findings that are happening, but nothing too advanced past the alveolar bone region. And then stage three is pain with exposed bone and radiographic changes past the alveolar bone. They give this bullet point list of five different things. So exposed necrotic bone extending beyond the alveolar region, two, a pathologic fracture, three, extraoral fistula, four, oral, antral, oral communication, and five, osteolysis extending to the inferior border of the mandible or sinus floor. So once you get to basically pretty advanced, extending through usually the whole aspect of the mandible or the maxilla, getting to the inferior border or into the sinus. Now it's more advanced, stage 3. Any other comments on the staging?
Just, you know, it's important to, that's something that's important to know. I feel like as residents, we could definitely get asked that frequently. We're going to see patients with MRONG, and knowing how to stage it is important. So just, again, a quick recap. So stage 0 is someone who looks like they have all the risk factors, but you're not seeing exposed bone, right? But they are having some pain. Yeah. That could be in stage 0. Stage 1, you're seeing the bone, no pain. Stage 2, you're seeing the bone, there is pain, but it's not like, you know, grossly infected or really involving a ton of the jaw. Stage 3, you're seeing the bone, it hurts, looks infected, and it's, you know, involving more of the jaw. You could have other severe features, you know, obviously the worst one. So knowing those 3 stages, and also just remembering the 3 points of diagnosing it, you know, they've had anti-resorptive medications, exposed bone for 8 weeks, no radiation or metastasis to the jaw, you know, rule those things out. So yeah. I feel like knowing all the background is super important, but having just those 3 points and then the 4 stages is like super high yield for being able to, you know, talk about this in clinic.
Okay. Backpedaling a little bit, but what factors do you consider when estimating someone's risk of developing MRONG?
So this is really interesting. I think this is something I learned, and it's an update from the 2014, you know, position paper, which was that the most important thing that you can look at when determining someone's risk for developing MRONG is why they had their anti-resorptive medications. Yeah. So that was, you know, I feel like we need to say that again, because that's, you know, a big take-home point. The most important factor to consider when determining someone's risk for MRONG is what the indication for why they had their anti-resorptive medication. Okay, so that could be, like we discussed, a number of different things, but the main one is either osteoporosis or some sort of cancer treatment, right? They talk a lot about the different, you know, risk that has tried to been estimated from different articles of patients in different categories and scenarios. And they found that there's kind of 2 ways to look at it. So one is, what is the patient's overall risk of getting MRONG? Because you can get MRONG in the absence of an extraction, you know, just from, you know, having periodontal disease or even almost spontaneously if you've been on these medications. So just what is your overall risk of that happening? And then secondly, which is probably more important to us, what is the risk of a patient developing MRONG if we decide to do a procedure on them, like extracting a tooth? So taking those 2 questions into account, let's talk about kind of the findings, because I thought it was interesting. So first, what's their overall risk? For a patient who's been on bisphosphonates for osteoporosis, almost regardless of the amount of time they've been on it, just if they've been on it for osteoporosis, the risk is typically less than 0.05%. So that's like, what, 5 in 10,000, if I'm not mistaken, which is, you know, very low. So essentially, it's considered low risk. For IV, you know, there's specific numbers we don't necessarily need to go into for, you know, if it was IV versus PO bisphosphonates. And it is a little bit higher in patients who are on denosumab for osteoporosis, up to 0.3. But in general, it's still, you know, considered low risk. For patients who had those because of malignancy, the risk is almost 100 times higher, which was reported as up to 5%. So, you know, now you can see why it's so important to determine why they were on it. Because we had discussed, you know, if you're on these medications for cancer, it's not just the cancer, it's not just the medication, but the fact that you're immunocompromised and you have all these, you know, other medical factors, you know, compounding that can increase your risk of getting MRONG, or at least that's the thought.
Yeah, and I was going to say that is, again, a take-home message of the article that I got, and something that I think maybe isn't very intuitive, because you'd think, oh, well, the risk of getting MRONG just got to be just related to whatever drug they took and how much of the drug, right? Regardless of the reason. But it really is much higher in patients who've, you know, are basically have had or having cancer. And probably because there's so many other immunocompromising things going on with that patient. And so it just makes them much higher risk once they have received these potent anti-resorptive medications.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the regimen is, you know, it is higher and they do receive more drugs, but it's, you know, doesn't appear to be high enough to make that kind of a difference without other factors.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to mention, you know, they did discussed a little bit about other reasons people are on bisphosphonates, you know, giant cell tumors, other bone diseases, you know, like in pediatric populations. Though the diseases for which people are on these, you know, as pediatric populations is kind of poorly studied, or I should say there just aren't many studies. So that's not super well known. And for people in the really rare scenario that you have a patient who's been on these medications because of giant cell tumors, their risk is like 0.7 to 5%. So it could be high, could be low. You know, it's definitely something to look into. You know, it's not just the run-of-the-mill osteoporosis.
Yeah.
So moving on, the more important question in my mind, and probably for most surgeons, is if you extract a tooth on a patient, you know, what is the risk of getting Emerange because of that, right?
Yes.
Which is kind of a slightly different question than the statistics we were just providing. So when they looked at that, there's three numbers that I kind of want to say, because I'm going to try to remember them. And if I feel like we can reference these as residents and as doctors, you know, provides more credibility to your background. So if you're taking out a tooth on a patient who's been treated with bisphosphonates for osteoporosis, the risk of them getting that is less than 0.15%. Okay. So still very low. If you're taking out a tooth on someone who has been treated with denosumab, still for osteoporosis, the risk is less than 1%, right? So anyone who's been treated with almost any of these medications for osteoporosis, from what we can see in this article, you know, summarizes, their risk is less than 1%.
Yeah.
And even lower if it was just bisphosphonates, you know? So considered low risk, which is good. If you take out a tooth on someone who's been treated with these bisphosphonates or denosumab for cancer, their risk is anywhere between 1.6 and 14.8%. But they say the vast majority of studies find it to be around that, you know, 1% to 5%. So kind of how we had mentioned before, maybe you could reference the generally accepted range is below 5%. But if you think about that, that's, you know, 1 in 20 cases. It's still considered higher risk.
Yep.
So, you know, overall, I would say summarizing, what does that mean? The 0.15%, 1%, and 5%. What does that mean? That means, in general, patients who have been on these medications for osteoporosis, typically you're going to want to discuss, you know, the risk and everything with the patient still, but you can consider them low risk and reassure them that it's, you know, relatively low risk procedure to go ahead with. And you could consider doing more routine things. In patients with treatment because of cancer, you're definitely going to want to take, you know, more precautions and avoid surgery as much as possible, especially if they're still like actively being treated.
And I'll say the patient with metastatic disease and who's had IV Zometa, in the article it says, you know, that there's other articles that report up to 18, sometimes higher percent of those patients getting Emerange.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, it is, at least in my experience, is more like somewhere between 15 to 20%. It's fairly common when you're taking out a tooth to see Emerange in these patients, because there's just, I think, such a poor immune response to the healing that they're much more likely. And that kind of leads us into the question of what can be done to reduce the risk of Emerange. So what are the things you can be doing before the surgery, during the surgery, to reduce their risk? I can kind of run through those and you can maybe comment afterward. Mm-hmm. The first one is, you know, perform high-risk surgical procedures prior to initiating therapy. So basically, before they start the anti-resorptive medication, try to get the work done, right? Especially those full mouth extractions, people who need a lot more work, or even if it is just one or two teeth, try to get all that stuff done before they start any of the medications. If they've already started and they're at risk of getting it, then certainly pre-op and post-op antibiotics have been shown to be helpful. Antimicrobial rinses, you know, using chlorhexidine pre and post-op, primary closure of extraction sites and trying to really get that soft tissue closed up. I would add just kind of minimizing the trauma to the patient during the extraction procedure or whatever other procedure you're doing. Maintaining good oral hygiene, so really instructing the patient on how to do that. And then maximizing overall patient health. So especially if this is a smoker or a diabetic patient, really trying to get them to stop smoking, you know, checking their sugars, making sure they're on point and they have really good control of their diabetes. Just any other health issue that can be basically knocking out their healing ability. Another one is the bone turnover markers. That's kind of been a big controversial topic. This article is saying that basically none of them are validated for clinical decision making. And so all the literature says we can't really rely on those. And then drug holidays is kind of our next question, you know, when and how much we do a drug holiday. But do you have any thoughts on those?
No, I think, you know, we definitely need to rely on our general dentist colleagues to, you know, do a good, thorough, comprehensive exam for these patients before they start their bisphosphonate or antiresorptive therapy and make sure that they can just, you know, either treat non-surgically or knock out the, you know, or refer for any, you know, major surgery that needs to be done to try to avoid these. And they discussed that since they implemented those recommendations, they were able to reduce the risk of people getting MRONG in patients who were like properly treated before therapy by, I think, like 2.5 times. So, you know, you can have a big effect on reducing the amount of MRONG if you just treat these things up front. And then other than that, like you mentioned, just when you're treating these patients and you have to do surgery, just using the best possible surgery, you know, most conservative, trying not to do, you know, big flaps, trying to, you know, not obviously do a ton of like troughing and drilling and just removing the tooth as atraumatic, you know, as they say, as possible with primary closure. And then, you know, related to the drug holidays, another one of those kind of controversial topics, I had heard in dental school, you know, like, you know, do it or, you know, consider it. Now the current recommendation is more leaning towards, you know, essentially it's not recommended for most medications. So the reason being, like we discussed for bisphosphonates, since they stick around for so long, you have to take into consideration that risk to benefit. If you're going to be stopping this medication to try to, you know, make things better for the MRONG risk, you're also going to be increasing their risk for whatever it was that they were being treated for, right? Having a, you know, a fall with some sort of vertebral fracture or, you know, some other serious fracture could be much more debilitating than, you know, having MRONG and getting that treated. So the fact that you have to stop those for, you know, potentially years and years to have any effect at all, it's kind of becoming more accepted to just not stop them. The main exception is the denosumab. Like we discussed, you know, patients who are receiving denosumab for cancer are going to be getting that really frequently, you know, like up to like once a month, depending on like the regimen. But so that's kind of out of the picture. But someone who's getting it for osteoporosis is going to typically be more like every 6 months. So in those patients, because the timing of denosumab by 6 months, it's almost, you know, doesn't have an effect anymore. You can try to time the treatment so that it's several months after their last dose, but still a couple weeks before their next dose, you know, 6 to 8 weeks before. So that way, you know, most of the drug is out. You do the extraction, give it some time to heal before they get their next dose. And that's something that you could even potentially discuss with their physician if needed. And I had, I think, two patients in the last couple months that I had to do this on. They had been taking Prolia and they were like, oh, hey, like I'm scheduled to get an extraction. Or they came in for a consult and they said, I have my next dose of Prolia in like 6 weeks or something like that. And I didn't have another opening for a month. And I was like, let's just do this today. So, you know, trying to do your best to optimize the timing, I think, can be very helpful in denosumab. But that's not to say that you're going to, you know, ask that they completely stop using it at all.
Yep. And denosumab goes by usually those two names, Prolia, which I believe was an injection given every 6 months, and then Xgeva, which is every month. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
Just be aware, look up denosumab, be aware of the other names, the indications that it's given. That's just a one that I'm seeing so often now in my practice. And those people basically take home message can benefit from a holiday. So good to coordinate it with their prescribing doctor, making sure that they're good to do the holiday and go from there. One other thing I wanted to mention, which I thought was interesting that this article mentioned, was under the inflammation and infection topic, they said it is clear that most extracted teeth had pre-existing periodontal or periapical disease. So the people who had Emrange, almost all of them, when it was due to tooth extraction, you could see, you know, before the tooth was extracted, that there was evidence of periodontal disease or periapical disease. And they go on to kind of talk about how usually there's some type of really strong inflammation going on, and that, take a tooth out that's got a lot of inflammation around it, that usually is what causes Emrange to start, you know, plus taking the anti-resorptive medication, you know, usually plus other things too that are compromising the immune system. But very unlikely, for example, to take out a tooth that's just carious and, you know, has no periodontal disease, has no periapical disease. Extremely likely for that tooth to go down the Emrange route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah. So that's all good information. As far as treatment, so someone who has full-blown Emrange, when do you, or maybe how do you treat somebody who has this?
Okay. So not going into the specific surgical, you know, technique for this particular episode of these purposes, but kind of the two overlying, you know, groups is you could either treat someone non-surgically or surgically. And this is also what stood out in my mind. One of the reasons I wanted to highlight this in comparison to the 2014 position paper was kind of the emphasis of this one. So firstly, non-surgical treatment, you know, includes things like local wound care, you know, cleaning it out, you know, oral hygiene, keeping that area, you know, free of debris, flushing it, mouth rinses, chlorhexidine, and then systemic antibiotics as needed. And then I believe they also included like the sequestrotomy here. So let's say they had like a real mobile piece of sequestrum, just kind of gently removing that. So I did see this in dental school. You know, I saw patients who were managed this way in dental school, you know, several years ago. This is typically for, you know, like a stage one asymptomatic patient, someone whose Emrange is not, you know, progressing, it's not really affecting them much, and it's small, or patients who are not, you know, good candidates to go to surgery. They can't go to surgery. They have a number of other factors, and you're trying your very best to just keep this, you know, at bay and not let it get too much worse for the time being. You could start with some non-surgical treatment. Surgical treatment is more involved, you know, involves, you know, either marginal resection, segmental resections, you know, for very large lesions, debridements, you know, up to, in the maximum, you have like a partial maxillectomy. I feel like the literature is really advanced in this category over the last couple of years, and just the things that I've heard from different surgeons. So, you know, the position paper officially states that, you know, there has been a clear, you know, body of evidence that's growing every day showing that surgical intervention can be very successful, even starting as early as stage one, which that to me was a big change in 2014, where they seemed to favor non-surgical, you know, more or in more scenarios than now, just due to the fact that more evidence is showing that surgical treatment is so effective. So kind of why, when would you use the surgical approach? Really any like progressive disease. So the Emrange is getting worse, you know, it's symptomatic, there's radiographic features, it's essentially, you know, affecting that patient's life more than just a small little asymptomatic lesion. So, you know, that opens the doors to a lot of different lesions that could be good candidates for surgery. And when they do surgery, without getting into the details, you know, the key I think every surgeon would agree on is removing all of the dead bone down to healthy bone. You know, so once you get down to the healthy bleeding bone, you know that all that dead bone is out of there and it gives it a chance to heal back up.
Yep. And one comment is if the disease is located above the neurovascular canal, you know, that's usually when you'd be doing a marginal resection. If it's extending down the inferior border, then usually segmental resection. And Dr. Sleevey did an awesome job of discussing this. He's a big proponent of doing resections when it's a progressive disease. So listen to that episode with Triple D because he's the man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He gives a lot of great insight on that and how successful he's been with that.
Exactly. So, I mean, Overall, I think those are the main points we wanted to go through in terms of what is it, what causes it, you know, what are the risks and how do we treat it? And it, just finishing up, I think it'd be nice to just discuss some like clinical scenarios like we like to do on the podcast and just talk about what people do on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, for you, how do you decide when to extract a tooth on someone who has been on some of these anti-resorptive medications?
So, you know, there's still, it surprises me, there's a lot of confusion, especially among the dentists who refer to me, a lot of confusion about extracting teeth, doing implants on the osteoporotic patient who's usually on Fosamax. And my experience is, you know, I'll talk to the patient and make sure their disease isn't progressing and they've kind of been on the same dose for a while, you know, no recent fractures or anything. That patient who's just super stable, you know, they're on this very common medication usually. Generally, the risk is so low, less than 1%, that a tooth that's, you know, has a clear indication to be extracted, there's no real issue extracting that tooth. You know, it's non-restorable, grossly carious, periodontal disease, periapical disease, root fractures, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And do you go over like the, just, do you have like a special paper they have to sign saying like bisphosphonates, you know, we talked about it, or do you just mention it to them?
Yeah, we have a bisphosphonate, or I should say an MRUNSH type consent form that explains, hey, you're taking these antiresorptive medications, you know, this is what osteonecrosis, you're at higher risk of this happening. You have to be aware of it, you know, sign. And then I talk to them, say, hey, you know, you're on this medication that basically impairs your bone healing. And, you know, if they're this patient I just talked about, the osteoporotic patient on Fosamax, then, you know, I say your risk is very, very low, less than 1%. You know, here's what to look out for. If after the surgery, you know, normal pain is during that first week or two. And then if you have extended pain or exposed bone, areas that are still kind of getting swollen and infected, and sometimes that's kind of happening in a cyclical nature, that's when, you know, you may be having this and you got to follow up with us. And here's kind of, you know, what the road you may take and how we would treat it. Have that brief discussion with them.
Yeah, I think that's huge. One thing I've noticed is sometimes patients get freaked out when you start mentioning that they're high, you know, quote unquote, high risk or higher risk for something. They're like, wait, what is going on? Do I want to do this? But like you just said, it's, you know, I try to be clear with my patients, you're at higher risk since you're on this medication, but you're still at very low risk for this happening, you know, less than 1%.
Right.
And guiding them through, you know, if this did happen, this is what it would look like, and this is what we would do down the road. I'd want to see you back. You know, we would still be here to help you out and take care of it. I think goes a long way helping the patients know that it's not going to just, you know, kill them or something.
It's a very different story for me if they've are the higher risk patient, you know, who has had cancer, has had IV bisphosphonates, or, you know, some of these other really potent medications, and they clearly demonstrate that they have a compromised immune system. Those are patients who I'm much more careful with, you know, really want to see what medication they took, how long they took it for, what's the status of their cancer, you know, and look at all the other factors that can be compromising their immune system. And then those are the patients where we have a discussion about, you know, you definitely are more likely to have exposed bone. Here's where it can progress. You know, it's very possible that you may need a resection to remove bigger pieces. You may need, you know, more surgery, sometimes even referring you to a hospital-based surgeon. So really kind of getting into that. And I think I'm much more careful with extracting a tooth. So only going to extract a tooth that really needs to come out, infected, clear signs of, you know, severe infection or inflammation. So the tooth that's just got caries and, you know, is not restorable, but has no periodontal disease and no periapical infection, usually that's one where we will say, hey, this tooth is a good candidate for, you know, coronectomy and root canal treatment, you know, and see see what they say. A lot of patients can't afford that, and sometimes we're just kind of watching the tooth, but usually we have the big discussion, and you know, generally it's a tooth that really needs to come out. They're in pain, so we take it out atraumatically, do everything pre and post op to help them heal, and most do fine.
Nice. So, you know, another common question, which this one is, you know, up front, it is a bit, there are varied opinions, you know, people will do very different things, and the article didn't have a clear answer. But what kind of, what are your thoughts, or what things have you heard about dealing with patients who would like to get implants, but have been on medications, you know, the anti-resorptives?
I've done many implants on patients with osteoporosis, and these medications, I always do the holiday if they're on denosumab. And honestly, I can say none of my patients have ever had exposed bone or Emrange with implants. Definitely not going to do an implant on the patient who's, you know, has history of cancer, metastatic disease, the higher risk. But these patients, I think if they have no other real health, you know, comorbidities and things going on that's kind of tanking their immune system, then I feel great doing an implant, and I haven't had any, you know, bad results.
Nice. Okay. Good to know. I mean, I feel like there's probably people out there, I'm sure there are people out there who wouldn't do implants on these patients, and there are definitely people who do them, you know, routinely. Knowing that, you know, you can do them and they can be successful is helpful. And the literature, you know, from what they said, that there's not clear literature saying how, if there is, you know, a very high risk, it's still probably very low. You know, just like any other procedure, routine procedure that you're doing on these patients, there might be a increased risk for developing Emrange, you know, just in general, but overall, it's still very low.
For sure. Yeah, so I think that's a good summary. I think one thing to be aware of is, I think we've, because a lot of literature says, oh, don't, no need for a holiday, super low risk. I think a lot of doctors, OMSs included, probably get into the habit of just kind of blowing it off, I guess you could say, and not even talking to the patient about it or the risk, or, you know, or maybe just have them sign a consent form saying, you know, you can get osteonecrosis, but the risk is so low, why even talk about it, you know? And so that, in my mind, is a little bit of a mistake and can potentially lead to more problems for you as a provider and problems for your patient. So even though it is very low risk, you know, it still is a higher risk, and patients should be informed. And often these patients are older and do have other immunocompromising issues. And so you've got to make sure everything that's going on with the patient before you do extractions and implants and things. Because I think the attitude in my mind has kind of shifted. Whereas when I was in dental school, it was like, everyone gets a holiday, and it's, you know, whatever, 3 months or 5 months, and everyone had these very specific numbers, and you got to talk to the patient, you know, for an hour and freak them out about doing this until they just scream and run out of the office and don't do anything, and then you're good because
then they're ready.
You never did anything. But it's, the tides have changed over the last, you know, 15 years, 10 years to almost the other extreme where we don't even talk about it at all, and we're just, you know, doing things. And so you can really get burned if someone does get Emrange and you never talked about it, never informed them, never did any other investigation about their other health issues, didn't maximize them for surgery. So be careful.
Yeah, absolutely. So having said all that stuff, definitely look out for the posts. I'm going to post a little kind of summary infographic, a couple pictures that will be helpful for this.
Yep.
And then our next topic, I was thinking, we have a brand new wave of residents coming in this coming month. They're going to be taking call for the first time, seeing a lot of fun stuff in the ED. We might talk about just some basics of like odontogenic infections and maybe some another topic that you might see commonly just when you're first starting out. So look for some of these episodes coming up here soon. We'll try to do them more, keep them as concise as we can, and try to make them helpful.
Yep. Thank you so much, Jake. Thanks for discussing this topic and for creating these good Instagram, Facebook little diagrams that can kind of summarize things. Is going to be real helpful, I think, for lot of people, especially those who don't have the time to listen to this whole episode.
Yep.
All right, my man. We'll catch you on the next episode.
All right. See ya.
Later. Thank you for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I would love it if you would also connect with us on Instagram and Facebook through our Everyday Oral Surgery pages. Also, if you are an oral and maxillofacial surgeon and would like to be on this podcast, please, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com, or you can text or call me at 720-441-6059. If you have any topics that you'd like to hear discussed on this podcast or feedback on certain episodes that have already aired, also please call or email me. I've found many of our interviewees through people contacting me after listening, and for that I am supremely grateful. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.